I want to talk a bit about microfluidics and at least the connection with fluid flow. So I mentioned last time that the connection is with the membrane, so that really the membrane is interacting with the fluid surrounding it, and that is imparting extra force, and the fluid also imparts force on the membrane. Here, we're dealing basically with drops, and the idea is that drop basically formation and manipulation is used in very widely in biological application, microfluidic application in particular, where, for example, doing DNA analysis or analysis of physiological fluids or protein crystallization. And basically what you're doing is using the droplets to improve the mixing efficiency. So in particular, you can do that by coalescence, so getting drops of different substances to coalesce, for example, or break up. And also inter-drop mixing, where basically you put two substances in a drop and you want to have them mix inside the drop. So that example is shown basically here, where the idea is to you can send them through a microchannel and use the channel geometry to control the hydrodynamic forces and get the drops to do what you want. So for example, here you have a drop with two substances in it, and you're going to send it down a channel, and then the complex channel geometry is going to result in mixing flow inside the drop and hopefully well mix the two substances by the time they get out. Here's another example where basically drops are coming in through a contraction chamber. They contract down. You have another drop. Depending on flow conditions, you can get these drops to merge to form a bigger drop that then gets drawn out. And then you can vary the flow parameters to get more different types of merger. So the typical flows that you encounter are in the usual the Stokes or the Navier-Stokes equation and the complex geometry, as I indicated before. You have topology changes, so you typically because you're going to have, at least in the cases when you have pinch-off and reconnection, and you have multiple fluids. And so what I want to talk about is methods for solving such problems, at least at larger scales, that have application to the microfluidics problem. And in particular, I'm going to talk about drop interface interactions and coalescence cascades in polymer blends. So I'll give focus that on a couple of examples. Yeah?
I'm just sorry. What do you mean by complex geometry, just the geometries that they're flowing?
You can think it's actually, it means a lot of different things. So. One is the geometry of the channels. Another is that you actually, if you have multiple fluids, then you really you have a free boundary problem, which if you compose in a regular domain has complex boundary, you know, complicated boundaries. So it actually means both. So now we're stepping a little bit away from microfluidics, and we're looking at drops interacting. And I want to show how the methods that you might need to develop to accurately simulate interactions. So I want to talk about a problem which was performed experimentally by Alan Longmire and a student, Mohammed Kasim, where basically they're dropping a drop through an ambient liquid. In this case, this is silicone oil, and the drop is a water glycerin mixture that's going to impact an interface that's between the silicone oil and the water glycerin mixture. So the drop is the same fluid as the one below. And so you could think of this as an interaction, a model of an interaction of a small drop with a large drop. The large drop is basically, you know, this flat interface. And what we want to do is try to resolve the hydrodynamic forces so that we can basically model the interaction region carefully and accurately. So let me just show you some experiments of what these things look like. So in this case, you have the drop coming down. So you see these are PIV, and these are little particles. And they do this for particle image velocimetry. Here's the drop, and it hits the interface, amazingly, it doesn't penetrate it, but it bounces back. And then we'll sit there for a while before coalescence actually occurs. And in this case, the silicone oil is In this case, on the right, the silicone oil is of a higher viscosity. And so here's the higher viscosity outside here. The drop is less deformed as it comes down. It rebounds less, but nevertheless comes up and sits down and looks quite similar to that guy once it's just sitting there. And then there's this very slow drainage gap, so that these things take a while before they merge. The drop rebounds, and then the coalescence is initiated 3D off-center. These are basically axisymmetric. So the mathematical model we would want to develop basically is a multi-phase Navier-Stokes system. So we have in the inner and outer fluid, you have the Navier-Stokes equations holding. So you have the inertial piece, the divergence of the viscous stress T, which has pressure times the identity matrix, and then the viscous stresses with a viscosity ratio mu. And then also the effects of gravity. And so the important non-dimensional parameters are the Froude number, the Reynolds number. And then we have the boundary conditions, basically the Laplacian boundary conditions between the inside and the outside of the drop. And that says that the jump in normal stress is proportional to the curvature, so the mean curvature times the normal. And then the coefficient would be the surface tension, or at least in this non-dimensional frame, the Weber number. So the Weber number is just the ratio between the inertial stress and the surface tension, inertial force and surface tension force. The Froude is the inertial force versus the gravitational force, and the Reynolds is the inertial versus the viscous force. And then the interface should move with the fluid, at least the normal component should move with the fluid, but also the fluid doesn't slip over the interface. That's the classical model. So that the velocity itself is continuous across the interface, but the normal stress has a jump. And so this is a highly nonlinear, non-local free boundary problem, non-local because of the fluid dynamics equation, the incompressibility equation. And so it's quite hard to solve. And there are many methods that have been used. So for example, boundary integral methods where you represent, you use layer potentials. So you can do that if the physics is limited, for example, if that were a Stokes equation or the viscid equation, that there would be no viscosity. Meshless methods, so particle methods, diffuse interface or phase field methods, front tracking methods. So for example, immersed boundary method or the immersed interface method, volume of fluid method, where here you're tracking basically component volumes inside a mesh cell, the level set methods, where that I had talked a bit about last time, and the trends now are basically to develop hybrid meshes, so hybrid methods, so you combine the nice features of each method and develop a hybrid method. And also to include adaptive mesh refinement. So if we go back to the drop interface problem, here's the rub. If you don't do anything, and if you don't do anything special, for example, you use a uniform mesh, even with a high resolution, you get a beautiful image, but it's totally wrong. Okay, from the experiment. So same experimental parameter. So it looks beautiful. You're very happy, it changes topology very nicely, and it has about 14,000, a little over 14,000 nodes, but you get unphysical coalescence. And the problem is that in order to resolve the near contact region, so the region that where you really have the lubrication forces that are preventing the coalescence, if you were to use a uniform mesh, it would be very expensive. Yeah. So this, I'll tell you in a minute. So this one is a finite element level 7. So this is I want to talk about a method we developed that's based on a finite element formulation of the fluid equations and then the level set framework. So So the idea is that we use, so to do the mesh refinement, well, you have different choices. You can use unstructured meshes like those rectangular meshes I showed in the last talk, or you can do unstructured meshes. So here you see triangles that change, and you don't really see the unstructured nature. Well, I guess you do a little bit. But the topology, the connectivity can change from time step to time step. And in 2D, we use triangles. And in 3D, we use tetrahedra. And this isn't the only approach. This is just one we took. You can do mesh mapping so that you can move the meshes to keep resolution. Or you can use structured refinement, and even structured refinement with triangles. So you could use some kind of hierarchy. The refinement we do is very flexible, and that's why we chose it. Where basically what you have is you imagine this is a mesh element, and what you do is you imagine that your mesh element is connected by springs. And the resting length of the spring is basically the local length scale you want to resolve. And so you can then define a mesh energy function that can then tell you what that local length scale is. And then you can write, so mesh density, and then you can write a mesh energy function, which is basically like the spring energy for the whole system. And then the optimal mesh is the global minimum of the spring energy. And so the whole key is how do you get to the global minimum, and you want to do it fast. So first thing you can do is just do Euler Lagrange. So basically you can try to equilibrate the mesh. But usually you do a few steps of that, and you're pretty much stuck at a local minimum. Then you have to do some kind of restructuring operation. So either node reconnection, so basically you go from this type of mesh to that type of mesh, or you do node addition and subtraction. And by doing these local operations, you drop the mesh energy and get very rapidly to close to global minimum.
So is this physically like a shear elasticity with a shear viscosity with a time step involved?
Yeah, it's like that. Now, the key is that we do it only locally. So we don't equilibrate the whole thing. And it's over-damped, actually, so we don't get oscillation. So now what you do, so we want to do the axisymmetric problem, and that's not so necessarily so easy to do with unstructured meshes. So what we do is we embed the axisymmetric problem in a slightly larger domain. And then we draw our domain in here, noted in red, and then we have to make sure that the mesh connects to the domain as we want. And so in other words, the triangles don't go over the domain. Okay. And so if you use, so then I'll show you, we use a projection algorithm to essentially project back onto the domain. But if you use this, then the algorithm can generate the nice adaptive mesh in complex geometry. This is a relatively simple geometry, but we've done it in more complex geometries. So basically what you do is you're just taking the mesh points that lie on the outside, and you project them back so that they lie on the, so we have an algorithm that projects them back. And then we have to equilibrate them, so we want the mesh to be still nice onto the axis of symmetry.
In this case, they can
jump over, and then we push them back, and then we reinterpolate. Because the mesh, the mesh we resolve according to the local length scales. In this case, for example, distance to an interface, and so you'll see in the simulation the mesh changes totally. And then after one time step, if the mesh changes and we don't impose that they have to lie on here, if they go over, we project them back. And so again, we have a CFL condition, so they never get very far from the axis of symmetry. So what we then do is, next point of view is to look at the, go back and do the Navier-Stokes equation But now we have to account for the surface tension forces. So the surface tension forces were first input or first included as a jump in normal stress. Okay? So an alternate form of the equation is instead of putting an explicit jump in normal stress, you can write an equation that holds in the whole domain, okay? But you put a singular stress, a singular surface stress, into the stress tensor. And this is the distributional form of the equation that then would give you the same classical equation. Okay? And so the it's the same except for this. Now this equation holds in the whole domain, and now you have a surface delta function projected in the tangential direction that's going to describe the surface tension forces. And then now the question is, how do you represent the interface? And so to represent the interface here, we used a level set representation. So basically, we had our function phi, whose zero set is the interface. And then, as you know, the nice thing about the level set is that it's easy to represent the normal vector and the curvature vector, which would be just the divergence of the normal. And the surface delta function also has a particularly nice form. It looks like a 1D delta function times mod of grad phi. And then we can make the density and viscosity change in terms of a characteristic function, which is which you can basically find. You know, basically, the characteristic function is 1 if phi is greater than 0 and minus and 0 if phi is less than 0. The interface then should move with the fluid. And so then the level set evolution equation we can just take is the advection equation. And this is when I gave. In the last talk, I had v mod grad phi, and that was because u was in the normal direction. The normal is grad phi over mod grad phi, so if I were to write the velocity u as vn, then I would get v mod grad phi. But if I'm just moving it with the velocity u, then it's just the advection equation. And one of the things that you want to do with a level set is you want to keep it looking like a sine distance function, meaning that you want grad phi to be about 1, to be about 1 in magnitude. And so one way to do that is to, after every time step or after every few time steps, to solve an auxiliary equation to drive grad phi, so this d is the evolved phi, to 1.
In which of those factors would you have the convection coefficient included?
The what, sorry?
Convection coefficient.
I guess I'm not exactly sure what you mean. So this is convection.
No.
Okay. And then this is convection. Okay. So to solve the equation, then we basically, you can use projection method. So we developed a second order projection method, which we call an Ozawa projection method, because it's a generalization of the Ozawa method for the Stokes system to the Navier-Stokes problem. And the point is that it's an iterative scheme, and usually after just a couple of iterations we get rapid convergence, so we only need a few iterations. An advantage of doing it this approach is that it's fully second order. The nonlinear terms are done accurately. The more iterations we do, the better the incompressibility is satisfied for the velocity, and you only need one time step. You know, it's a one-step method. So to solve the spatial problem, we use finite elements, and we use P2, P1 elements. We started out with a mini element, but P2, P1 works better. To solve the level set equation, we use a discontinuous Galerkin method, which is basically like solving locally on each element, and then but not imposing continuity across elements, instead putting them through fluxes. And then the surface tension term, we use the tensor form, so the singular stress form, and then you integrate by parts in the weak formulation, and you never have to compute curvature. Okay. So that's a nice piece that you don't have to do. To do the reinitialization, in other words, to keep the level set like a distance function, we use a the explicit positive coefficient scheme developed by Barth and Safian. And to do the adaptive mesh, what we do is we say the local length scale at just at some point x is basically like the distance of x to the interface. So in other words, the closer to the interface, the more resolved we're going to be. So the actual formula is here. We can write that in terms of the level set function, because the level set function is like the distance function. And so we're going to go from some, local length scale will be the minimum of some overall grid length. So that's, you can imagine, as the grid length of the boundary. And then some length near the interface, the minimum grid length near the interface, what you want to resolve, and then it increases away. So in other words, the grid size is going to start near the interface at h, but then increase away up to h0. I just want to make a point about efficiency. If we look at an adaptive method compared to non-adaptive methods, so for this particular method, we found that the solver takes n, in 2D, takes n to the 5/4 or n to the 7/6 amount of work in 3D, and n is the total number of points. Okay, so why does that have to be Bayou stuff, Bayou efficiency? Because you don't have to resolve the whole region, you have to resolve only part of the region. So for example, if you're doing an interface problem and you're only resolving around the interface, then you're only resolve, then you, the number of points is going to increase with the lower dimensional set. So in other words, the total number of points is going to behave like 1 over the grid, this minimum spacing, h, to the n minus 1 if you're in n dimensions. And so what that means is that you have a huge reduction in computational cost by going from the adaptive to the non-adaptive, and even compared to the boundary integral if you were just using direct summation. And the remeshing cost is lower than this. So it's lower, and so it's very small compared to the overall cost of the solvers. So for example, if you were trying to compute to a gap of 10 to the minus 3, so h is 10 to the minus 3, and you compare the cost of the adaptive and non-adaptive, you find that using the adaptive would give you a 6,000-fold increase in computational time. So now let's compare to the experiment using this method. So on the left is the experiment, and on the right is the simulation. And so there's really quite excellent agreement between the two. And in fact, what you can see from down here, the drop deforms the lower interface and then comes back up, and you actually capture the rebound. So by using the adaptivity, you're able to get that. So let me just show you what this guy actually looks like. So here's the drop. It's originally starting spherical. This is axisymmetric. The mesh is as you see it. This is the initial mesh, and the adaptive mesh, as we let it go, is going to follow the drop as it falls. So the drop is falling due to gravity, and then it's going to deform the interface. You're going to highly resolve, and it comes back up and just sits there.
Is the gas phase modeled also?
This, it's actually two liquids. So this is oil, so it's another liquid. If it were gas, then you have basically, you could model that as a liquid with a small density.
So it's as I wasn't sure what we're looking at. It's oil on the top.
Oil.
Water.
Oil.
Top,
water. Water. So again, the water drop falling through the oil, and then it's going to bend the interface and bounce back. Eventually, in the method, it will merge, but the merger is now controlled because you can control the smallest edge size. Okay.
I have to be picky, but what about the physics? As the drop impinges on the water reservoir with this interstitial layer of oil, there's
so
other forces that come to play.
There's absolutely. So we're not modeling the so. We're not modeling the attractive van der Waals attractive force here, but that would come into play. But you have to basically get down to very small scales in order for that to happen. Just even the lubrication force will keep them separated for quite some time. And then once you get down to the van der Waals scales, then they'll want to merge. So that could be built up, but we haven't done that yet.
But this is something I'm trying to figure out. Does this take into account, like, even the entrainment effect of the oil and high Reynolds numbers and other things that are in the equations?
So basically what we're doing is we're simply solving the Navier-Stokes equations, but accurately. So we're accurately getting the lubrication force that just comes up from the fact that you have, you know, a body next to an interface next to another one. So we're automatically capturing that. And again, if you didn't do this the adaptivity, you'd have no hope to get that accurately. So here I wanted to show what the mesh looks like. So this is at the point of impact. Okay? And I'm going to blow up this box by 10 times, several times. So the drop came down, is now sitting on the interface, and this is what the mesh looks like. So you blow it up 10 times, there is the drop. Now I'm going to blow up this region. That's going to blow up that region. And then there's the interface. And so in fact, it's a very nice scaling of the mesh. So the mesh is basically scaling. I've blown it up exactly the difference between H and H0. So these mesh elements, if I went back to the original picture, would look the same size as the ones that were originally on the boundary. So the mesh is really behaving very well. And this is showing the computational node, how the number of computational nodes increases as a function of time. So you just use a few at the beginning until they start to interact, and then you increase as you're trying to resolve the interaction zone. And here, basically, we're using about 16,000 total nodes, so not much more than what we used in the uniform mesh, where the thing just went right through, but they're well placed. And this is just a quantitative comparison with the experiment. So what these curves are positions of the upper drop surface here, and the lower drop surface and the interface here. So remember, the drop is coming down. If you go on the symmetry line, there's the top part of the drop, the bottom part of the drop, and the interface. So this is the top part of the drop, the bottom part of the drop, and the interface. And so the circles are the experiments, and the solid line is the simulation. So we're really at least certainly getting this region very accurately.
And the parameters were taken just from tables, or did you just...
The parameters were taken... No. The parameters were exactly as measured in the experiment.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly matched. Basically, to just make the point, you'd have to use this many elements in the uniform mesh to resolve that.
Just, could you go back to the picture
a second?
This one? I was just curious, yeah, just to try and understand the physics a little bit.
So what this is doing is that you're having this essentially linear drop until they interact. Okay, so this is the lower drop surface. So this is the position of the lower drop. And then once this is the
lower
position of...
Meaning the flat reservoir.
No, sorry. Let me draw a picture.
The lower portion.
So this is that guy compared to that guy.
Okay.
And then the other one is that. So the upper one,
right,
this
so
upper one
is
this
guy. Trying to figure out where the deviations, what do the deviations tell you? So this technique is apparently, right, it's able to capture the linear portion, but what's it not capturing?
Well, and it's also capturing the rebound. This is the rebound.
So this is a function of...
So this is the position as a function of time.
Time.
And it's normalized at the position of the original flat interface. So that's what's set to be zero. So you're doing very well, and you start to deviate once the thing is coming back up. Because also, even though it's coming back up, that means the top part has gone down, it's coming back up. The overall, at this point, you can't see any difference between the lower, at least on the scale, between the lower drop surface and the interface. That means these two are basically on top of each other on that scale. Okay, but there's not merging yet, because there's some small difference between them. And then it's come down, that's what this means, it's come down to the bottom, and then it's going back up. Down and then going back up.
So no, I'm not picking up because this is saying that the solid line, so the simulations have it rebounding faster than the actual experiment, right?
Yes, a little bit faster than the actual experiment. And I think that's, so there's several reasons that could be. So one could be resolution. We're still not completely resolved because even though it's coming back up, fluid is still draining out. So we might need even still more resolution to capture that. It could be that the experimental parameters are not quite right. So there's experimental error in the parameters, whereas in the simulation, we use exactly what's given to us by the experimentalist. So it could be that there's enough error that could cause this kind of effect.
But if you fix that, it would screw up the other part, though, because you're using the same, you have to use the same density.
You have to use the same everywhere. So but you may have more freedom to be close here, and this is very delicate.
Well, who says that it's going to screw up? You have to figure out how sensitive this is with respect to the parameters involved. I can't guess how sensitive that is.
No, but I mean, if you have to...
This part certainly will be very sensitive.
Forces are pretty large. I mean, for the surface tension, a change in a few dynes will change the rebound significantly, just knowing what the experiment is. But I'm trying to figure out what this is telling us. I'm trying to look at the negative. In other words,
yes.
If it's coming down, the simulations undershoot the experiments. On the rebound, they overshoot. I'm trying to figure out what does that mean then for the interface model.
Well,
is it that it's too stiff, or what is it actually telling you? Right.
So for example, this it go. What it would be telling me it's less stiff, right?
No,
because
it's
going down.
If you look at the other branches, see.
This one, sorry.
Yeah. No, further, earlier in time.
Here.
Yeah, you see how either the top one or the bottom one. In other words, the experiments show it being further away from the bottom drop, and then on the rebound, they're closer. So there's some physical mechanism that's not capturing. I'm trying to figure out what it is, just from the comparison.
Yeah, I'm not sure. My feeling is that this deviation is within the experimental error.
But it's systematic. It's not random. It's systematic. It overshoots.
I understand. And so what I think is actually that the experimental parameters, at least compared to the simulation, the experimental parameters are not quite right. In other words, what they tell us is actually not quite right for that flow. We have to change something a little bit to make it match here. And we did a little bit of that, but we don't have a lot of feeling about how much to change it. But you're right, there's this systematic error where you're sliding a little bit below. But that's my best guess about what that is. I think the Navier-Stokes equations are working fine here. It's not
no,
a problem equation.
No
doubt. So.
The other question I had is I'm not familiar with all the different numerical techniques that are used. But for problems involving pinch off, you know more about this. Whenever I at least in the, you know, as of five years ago or so, it looked like simple tracking schemes did pretty well at describing pinch off. So why did you say before that for this problem here, those old techniques will never work and the water would merge instantly? I don't understand that.
Because you're not resolving so regardless of how you represent the interface, if you're not resolving the lubrication force, if you don't resolve the lubrication force, that's the only thing that's keeping the interfaces from merging. So if you don't resolve the lubrication force, no matter what method you use, you'll have intersection.
So, but that's buried in the Navier-Stokes equation.
Correct.
Itself.
That's buried in the Navier-Stokes equation.
So what's another way to say, in other words, sort of what resolution did you need?
You need to resolve the...
like on the scale, say, of the curvature of the interface.
Well, it depends how close you want to get them. So suppose you want to get them, you know, to a gap of 10 to the minus 3. Compared, that 10 to the minus 3 should be taken assuming that the radius of the drop is 1.
Okay.
And so you need then, for that gap of 10 to the minus 3, you usually need 3 or 4 mesh points at least to resolve that.
Right.
And so that tells you how much resolution you need.
And so doing it this method, you're saying you get that for free?
No, you pay for it because you have to develop the adaptive method.
Okay.
But if you used a uniform mesh everywhere, then it would mean you'd need that very tiny mesh size everywhere that you didn't need it. You know, that wouldn't make any effect. If you're doing front tracking is fine, and if you're 2D or axisymmetric, you can change topology relatively easily, but you have to do something by hand. But in 3D, you'd have a much harder time changing topology. Whereas the idea of this type of approach could be then extended to 3D.
Okay.
In fact, I, the beginning I showed the dumbbell pitching off. That was actually a drop pitching off in 3D.
Can I ask
yeah.
one question? Is it possible that, that the thing lies in the fact that, that at you sort of have a singular perturbation near the near the free interface that you're losing with the uniform method, and here, I mean, there's a scaling method that engineers sometimes use for, like, you know, airplane wings, and you look real close to where the shocks are forming. It's, I forget what it's called, but seems to me it's a kind of singular perturbation near the free boundary.
Well, there is, you know, there is a layer of vorticity, for example,
yeah.
that's being shed from
yeah.
the boundary. And I hope that we're resolving that reasonably, because basically we're not, we're just saying that around the interface we are, you know, putting a fine mesh. If you remember the mesh, it's
right.
even
right.
around
yeah.
the jaw
yeah.
is, you know,
right.
even, you know, up here you have the fine mesh. So imagine that's what's happening as it's coming down. Then you have the fine mesh here. So we're resolving some of that, but maybe we're not resolving it far enough away. That's also possible. This, what this drop does as it comes down is it sheds vortices off the sides, and you have these trailing vortices in the back. And we may not be resolving those adequately. We tried different resolutions, and it didn't seem to...
Yeah, you showed a picture. It's interesting. You showed a picture before when you showed the two snapshots experiment there and
yes.
the falling drop. And your drops have a dimple at the top that the experiments don't seem to have.
Let's take a look.
See, or cause by a dimple.
So,
there's a protrusion.
Yeah,
at
so
the
this
top
pro-
there,
that's right.
It's not
so, yeah, no, so that's a good point. And it's not completely clear what that's due to. So, for example, the way they do the experiment is the drop is released very far from the bottom of the interface, from the flat interface. And so what they say, the experimentalists say, is that it more or less does whatever it's going to do, and it reaches some kind of steady shape,
mm-hmm.
and then it falls with that steady shape. We didn't drop ours as far
that's
away.
Far, right.
So it could be that this is just simply because we haven't allowed the shape to reach a steady size.
How important are the lateral boundary conditions? I mean, you have 1/r hydrodynamics and so on.
Yeah, so here what we've done is we've allowed the boundary to be free. So here we just have zero normal stress here, so it just moves up and down as it needs to. There, we also did some comparison to make it wider, but it didn't seem to make too much difference. The tank is pretty big, so there's very little interaction with the wall. This is done right in the center of the tank.
In the experiment.
No, no, so as I say, in the simulation, we did make it bigger, but it wasn't much effect. Okay, so now we can talk about extensions of where to go with this method. So one way is to start developing a hybrid method. So one of the things with level set methods, you have very nice representation of geometry, but you have little control, not very much control over the component volume, let's say the amount of fluid contained in one of the phases in a drop. The volume of fluid, on the other hand, you're tracking volumes, so you have complete control over the volume. You know volume will be explicitly conserved. So one type of method that people have developed are coupled level set volume of fluid methods. So this was done by Puckett and Sussman quite some time ago, and Sussman has continued to work, I think, in at least part of it in this area. And then what we did is we took our this adaptive level set method and we coupled it with the volume of fluid to better preserve volume. So here is just an example of a drop extended, but where the volume error is really very small. Of course, it's also important to extend to complex fluids. So, for example, level set methods has been used to simulate viscoelastic flow. We've also used level set to look at surfactants. Here's a surfactant, but I'll skip that one. So basically, if you want to resolve near neighbor interactions, so drop-drop or drop interface interactions, the message is that you have to be careful. So you have to, you can get simulations to look very nice, and topology changes very easily, but is incorrect interactions. So you have to be careful. You have to build that in with resolution. So for example, using adaptive mesh somehow. The next thing I want to talk about just at the in the end is what you can do to simulate a polymer blend. So this is a different kind of problem where coalescence is really important, actually. So the idea here is that if you take two or more immiscible polymers, and you take, let's say, drop matrix phase, so you take a bunch of drops surrounded by a matrix of fluid of the other type of polymer, if you subject them to intense mixing, then if your volume fraction of the dispersed phase is high enough, you can create sponge-like microstructure. So in other words, you can go from something that looks like this to something that looks like this, okay, at high enough volume fraction. And so the phases will be interpenetrating, meaning that the dispersed phase will actually become continuous. And the matrix phase remains continuous, and so you get what's called a co-continuous morphology, two continuous phases.
You need surfactants to stabilize that, or?
Say again?
You need surfactants to stabilize something?
Yeah, correct.
Like for all polymers and stuff?
Yes. So if you let these things sit, they'll coarsen,
yeah,
and you'll get rid of it. And if you want to stop the coarsening, you add block of polymer. Okay. Exactly. So this is an important route to new materials. So, for example, developing scaffolds for bioengineering, something relevant to this workshop. Also, for solid materials with very good thermal and diffusional properties. So, for example, what you typically find is, for example, the strength. So these are strains, but also you could have you can have, for example, for diffusional, if you want to build a diffusional barrier, usually one of the materials is expensive, one is cheap, so you want to use as little of the expensive one as possible, but still have a barrier. And if you develop, so imagine that you want to prevent diffusion of one substance across an interface or some region containing this stuff. Then if you're one of the phases is a diffusion barrier, by making that phase continuous, you're going to prevent totally diffusion across. Here's just an example, some micrographs of a polymer blend. So going from the drop phase at lower volume fraction to some kind of extended drop phase and then to co-continuous or sponge-like phase.
Didn't you have the diffusion barrier for, because this is a y-continuous phase. I mean, if A is continuous, B is continuous as well.
That's right, but... that's right. So maybe that wasn't the best. So I was thinking, suppose you cap it. You know, probably that's not the best example. That's one. Another could be if you want to increase conductivity. So if one is highly conductive but expensive, one is less, then you'll get a peak when you get the co-continuous morphology.
The Shear modulus would also be mastered. Right?
Say again?
The Shear modulus would be mastered.
Yes. And kind of indicate here with strain. So the features are that you have fully 3D structures. They're difficult to detect because you have this complex sponge-like morphology. So you'd like to say how you could detect it. And you want to know how to form, what are the important control parameters for forming them? And then, as you mentioned, what is their stability? Because they're really not, these sponge-like structures, they're not equilibrium. And from the theory of numerics side, well, you have many topology transitions because you have this coalescence cascade. You have a bunch of drops coalescing. And so you have a large number of interfaces and very complex microstructure. And so you want to use a continuum method. And you could use a level set method, but instead, what we thought is a good method is to use the phase field method. So here I'll give an example of the phase field formulation of fluid dynamics versus the level set formulation. So basically, when you do the phase field method, again, what you do is you take the Navier-Stokes equation and you extend to the whole domain. And then what I haven't shown here is that in the fluid energy, you would add an energy that looks like the interface energy, but now rewritten in terms of the phase field variable. And when you then take the variation and you figure out what the extra force is that goes in the fluid, the extra force looks something like this. Not exactly like this, but something like this. Now let me say what this term, and then you have to have an equation for how the phase field variable moves. Okay, so the phase field variable is C. So the viscosity is a function of, so this is the viscosity ratio, it's a function of C, let's say linearly interpolated. And now let me talk about this. So in the actual phase field formulation, if you did really the energy variation, you wouldn't have, it would be, what you would have here is a term that would look a bit different than this. It would be divergence of C tensor C. Okay? But I want to point this out. So look at C, imagine C equals a half is the interface. So this guy is the normal vector to the interface. Divergence of the normal is the curvature. Then you have gradient C. So if I take gradient C, I divide by mod grad C, I get the normal. And then I have another, I have this guy with one from the denominator, so that's squared. And I have epsilon grad C squared. That epsilon grad C squared is like the surface delta function. Okay? This is the curvature, and that's the normal vector. So it's the phase field analog of the level set formulation. And this eliminates, actually, some spurious currents that would arise in the usual phase field method. The phase field equation, well, if it were just level set, you would have just the pure advection equation, so the right-hand side would be zero. But now the phase field equation adds a little bit of diffusion, chemical, it's thought of as chemical diffusion, in the fluids, basically in all the cases. So you have divergence of a mobility times the gradient of the chemical potential, and then the chemical potential is related to a free energy, C, and then capital C, which is related to the interface thickness. So here's a slice, so you see transition of C going from 0 to 1 over a region of small thickness. And so you can show that, at least away from topology transitions, this system, as you take epsilon goes to 0, converges to the sharp interface. And this is just making the point that in the usual weak formulation, you replace this by surface delta function times the normal times curvature, surface tension. That's exactly this analog here. So to do the numerical method, you basically use a projection method for the Navier-Stokes equation and a Krank-Nicholson type discretization, like what I talked about last last lecture for the concentration equation. And then you can look at evolution compared to classical theory. So here's, for example, just the pinch off of a column of fluid. So you have periodic boundary condition, it's pinching off due to the Rayleigh instability, and it pinches off and forms, you know, the satellite drops. And you can compare the theory to the linear stability theory, so at least at short times. So the linear stability theory, the mitomatika is here, and the convergence as you take the mesh and epsilon to zero at the same time is tending towards it. Now, let's go to the co-continuous morphology. So really what you want is now to represent this very complex system, and and use the phase field method to represent the interface and to allow all the transitions and so on. So what we're going to do is we're going to put this in a basically a driven cavity flow. So, but it's a little bit more general than that. We have a velocity up here, a velocity down here. This is what happens if you just take a bunch of particles and you track what happens in the flow. They should tend to get more or less equally spaced. So so that the it's a pretty good mixing flow. You have to do a few revolutions, but then this is the so this is the background flow we're going to impose. So now what we do is we vary the volume fraction of the dispersed phase, and we create the initial sample by doing spinodal composition. So in other words, we let the polymers essentially phase decompose, and then we apply the shear flow. And so this is the morphology after you've applied this random shear flow. This is just an experimental micrograph. And so then what we do is we do a whole bunch of simulations where we measure the interbase length overall as a function of the concentration of dispersed phase, basically going from small volume fraction to large volume fraction. And what we find, and then we want to, so these are morphologies corresponding to those cases. So at the small volume fraction, you basically have drops, they get mixed up after some time. But then as you go up in volume fraction, the drops then tend to coalesce and form more co-continuous structure, basically around here, around the 50%, usually between 35 and 50%. And then what we did is we took volume averaged, basically averaged data for many simulations and constructed curves that relate the total interface length to the concentration of dispersed phase. And what you find is that near the center, near 50%, you tend to have a decrease. It's a little bit hard to say, certainly at the beginning. And the co-continuous region is basically in here. And what we've been trying to do is use the simulation to get a detection. So this is the experimental result for the same quantity, interface area per unit length, so it's actually dimensional, versus essentially concentration. Here it's weight percent. So what you have is during mixing, you have the rise of this interface area, and then a dip between about 35 and 65% that this is believed to be the co-continuous region experimentally. And then a decrease again. So the idea is that the co-continuous morphology is allowing you smaller surface area per unit length, basically, or interface area per unit, interface length per unit area, compared to the drop phase, okay, because you actually had transition. Now, a question was, what is causing this big dip? Okay, is that real or is that experimental? So if you go back and you look at our simulation, they don't really show much dip. Okay, this is a little bit down, but it's not much. You could imagine it's more or less there. There's not too much difference between, these regions. So experimentally, what they do, though, is when they measure this rheology, they take the sample out. They move it as fast as they can to the rheometer, basically, and then calculate the area. And the prediction is that there's actually coarsening going on, and the coarsening will affect this region much more than that region. So here's an example. If you just quantify that, so you said, now, let's take the sample out, okay, everywhere, and let it just sit and anneal, in other words, coarsen by surface energy, then what you find is that the co-continuous region, or this region, drops dramatically, and the other ones drop, but not nearly as dramatically. And so it's believed that this actually is experimental, a result of the experimental configuration, how they do the measurement. And here's our simulation of annealing. So basically, you have something that looks more or less uniform, but then as you anneal, this region of large concentration drops dramatically compared to the remaining one. And then here are just some sample morphologies under annealing.
Just out of curiosity, do you know how they measure the interface length?
Experimentally, they do it. Yeah, they do it through image processing. So what they do, they do 2D, and so what they're plotting is interface length per area of the drop. And the idea is statistically that should be equivalent to interface area per unit volume.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do. So now we've been working in 2D. We're also have some results in 3D, which are qualitatively similar, but we don't really believe our we don't fully trust the 3D simulation simply because we don't have the adaptive mesh yet here in 3D for the Navier-Stokes solver that's on the way, and so I'm concerned about the resolution we can afford. And so, as I mentioned, there's some future directions here. Clearly, adaptive mesh refinement with the level with the phase field method. Basically, if we can use the framework that I discussed for the Willmore problem earlier, and that's we're working on that to extend that to the Navier-Stokes system. The complex domain. So everything I showed was pretty much a nice rectangular domain. We can do it in much more complicated domains, and it's straightforward, relatively speaking, to do that with unstructured mesh. But with structured mesh, because you have to work a bit harder. Also, you want to do multi-components, so more than two fluids. So we've done a little bit of that, but there's much more that could be done. This is just a picture of a drop coating another drop. The heaviest fluid is in this drop. This is a light fluid. This is a heavy and a light. And the fact that this fluid is light brings the drop up, pulls it up above the interface, and actually lets it sit, surface tension, and holds it sitting on the interface. It's kind of a curious simulation. Also, extending the phase field type approach to viscoelastic flow, there's been some work in this direction, but more needs to be done. So with that, let me stop.